And the same way, of course, not only is he conventional in terms of the enactment of religion, he's wholly conventional in terms of his attitude to the papacy. Henry's first war is fought as a, not a papal fief, not as in the old days, somebody who's kind of infeudated to the Pope, but it's actually a vassal, but it's actually fought as an ally, protesting that the prime reason that he fights is the assault that the French have delivered to Julius II. And again, I'm looking at this in detail at the moment. What is very striking is the number of Henry's bishops that one might have imagined would support peace, like Wareham, and I think particularly John Fisher of Rochester, who come in heavily on the side of war because of the fact that it's war in support of the Pope. So this is the background from which Henry emerges. These are the ways in which he seeks fame. At the beginning of his reign, he seeks it as a military hero, and he comes nearer to it than we might think, actually. I know that the actual conquests, the expense of vast, vast treasure in 1513, because again, the old stories that Henry VII died leaving an awful lot of cash are true. Absolutely no doubt about it. And I think Bacon's figure of between 1 million and 1.5 million is right. It's blown in 6 months. But remember, ladies and gentlemen, it's just like now. The British once, the Americans now, are discovering that great power status involves national bankruptcy. That's what it's about. You know, that's the price of glory. That's the price of fame. And Henry gets it, and it's very striking that whereas his father, in most ways, I think, is a figure, certainly in broad... Remember, European politics actually mean the Italian wars. That's what the great European powers talk about. Henry VII has no interest, very sensibly, has no impact upon Henry VIII's whole policy. For the first 20 years of his reign is determined by the Italian wars. And I'm looking very hard at one of my former students, Glenn, at this point. Absolutely, which I think he would agree. That's what it's all about. But Henry, because of what he did, the way he puts himself on the map in 1513, the conquest from France, the having an emperor serving at his side, again, deliberately modelled on Henry V, gets him that fame. Gets him that European reputation, gets him that place, punching above his weight in his place at the top table. Have you noticed this illusion of British politics, which seems to repeat itself? But anyway, what I think is very striking, of course, is also just to have some awareness of what an extraordinary achievement it was. England probably has got a population of 2.5 million. France is 15. England is about, what, a fifth of the... between a fifth and a quarter of the surface area of France. And the revenues of a king of France are 1 million, and those of an English king fluctuate between 100,000 and 120,000. So it's not bad, but you can't keep it up. So what Henry, with the genius of Wolsey, then has to do is to pursue fame by an alternative method. You've tried war, too expensive. What do? Well, you try peace. You do this wonderful, it's very modern politics, this is Mandelsonian, isn't it? You know, you failed at war, what do you do? You proclaim that what you were really interested in is peace. But to make peace, and ladies and gentlemen, we do know this. I mean, isn't it interesting, the fascination which war has for mediocre politicians? Bush, Blair, Brown. They love war. You know, it gives you that epic sense. I think, and they probably express themselves being a bit sad about the casualties, but, you know, it's a necessary part of the processes of fame. Well, the real problem is, how do you make peace interesting? Peace really is boring. And that's true when we've had nearly a century of propaganda for peace following the First World War. Remember, in the 16th century, as in the 18th and 19th and every previous century, war is regarded as a good thing. Peace produces idleness, produces corruption. War is the test of virtue. War is the test of valour. So Henry's got quite an uphill job. There is, of course, a collection of rather odd people, like More and Erasmus, arguing that Christ had a rather dim view of killing with swords and whatever, but, you know, normally they don't camp, but at the moment they becoming quite useful if what you want to do is float the peace idea. But Woolsey's masterstroke is peace with glory. And it's very impressive. I mean, you think of sort of equivalent attempts with the United Nations Charter, where you've tried to jazz the thing up. Woolsey does it so much better. The first great peace treaties of 1518, the Treaty of London, the title, look at it, the Treaty of Perpetual Peace. What it is, it's actually a cheapo settlement between England and France, in which England has got to give back its French conquests because it can't actually afford to keep them. What you do is you dress it up as a pan-European security pact with England as the guarantor of general European peace. Ladies and gentlemen, if the EU and its federal dreams ever become real, Wolsey is going to appear along with, you know, Charlemagne, along with Charles V, Napoleon and Hitler as one of the founders of European unity. He really is. This is the first idea of Europe since Rome, really, of a pan-European security pact. It's brilliant. And then what do you do? Well, you follow it up with the equivalent of an Olympic Games. As we will discover in 2012, you pour enormous amounts of money away, and sport is minimally interesting, but what's really important is, as it were, competitive national glory. Look at here we've got it, of course, the painting of the Field of Cloth of Gold. It looks exactly like a modern expo. You have this huge, fancy, you know, pavilion temporary architecture. The English wipe the French. The name Field of the Cloth of Gold is, of course, French, because that's what the French tents were. They were all blown over. It was typical June weather in Northern Europe, so it was cold and very powerful winds. The star of the show was the English temporary pavilion, which, knowing what the weather would like, they had the wit to build out of wood. So it stood up, and it did. It's a great thing, the structure that appears in the middle. Anyway, this is peace with glory, with a kind of combination of an Olympic Games and you know, an international expo, but with wonderful sense of theatre. One of the most peculiar things about that painting of the Field of Cloth of Gold is this strange dragon which appears in the middle. Historians have long failed to realise, one or two, Jocelyn Russell did come up with this, this was a real firework, which was let off at the moment that Wolsey was elevating the host on the site of the lists. In other words, where there'd been all the jousting, you symbolise peace by actually building a chapel of reconciliation and Wolsey very rarely bothers to celebrate Mass, but is actually celebrating Mass. And they let this firework off at the moment of hoc est corpus. So, of course, half the people fall on their knees thinking the Holy Ghost has actually appeared as this thing sort of shoots over you. This is the literal world. It's brilliant. But that too comes to an end. You can only punch above your weight for a certain period of time. And by the middle of the 1520s, it seems to me Henry doesn't have an heir. He's fallen out of love with his wife. There's no longer any point in trying to pretend that he can swing the balance of power between Francis I and Charles V. His reign is played out. He's a failure. And then, miraculously, he falls out of love with Catherine and into love with Anne. And this should have destroyed him. There's a very interesting Flemish account of Henry written about 1532, which says, until this point, Henry, and it's a very interesting comparison, Henry had been as famous as King Arthur. Now, he's villainous, you know, he's broken with the church, he's broken with his first wife, he's marrying this dreadful woman, Anne Boleyn. But it seems to me that that marriage, and of course, the equally fortuitous fact that, again, the exhibition in the British Library has the letter from the Vatican, not from the archives of the Vatican, but from the Library of the Vatican, the most important of the Anne Boleyn love letters, where you can date the moment at which Henry and Anne promised to marry each other to the first, second, or third, roughly there, of January 1527. And once you've actually got that date, of course, Eamon was kind enough to compliment me on the Six Wives book. Once you've got that date, you've got the whole chronology of the divorce established. Within a few weeks of that, Henry suffers conscientious scruples like German measles. I challenge anybody in this room, including my academic colleagues, obviously, to come up with a scrap of evidence that Henry had ever expressed any doubts any theological or legal or any other scruples about his marriage before the first trial of his marriage. There is none. In other words, they agree to marry first. No woman will be surprised, at which point the man starts looking around for reasons as to how he gets out of it. That's the chronology. Normally, I don't think the Pope would have greatly worried. After all, if you look at successive queens of France who were discarded so that Anne de Bretagne can continue to be married to the French king, you would see what the argument that peace and security override all other considerations would be. And I think you could have put forward a pretty convincing argument about the need for a male heir. But to Henry's immense misfortune, only a week or two after Wolsey decides that the case really is too difficult to settle in England, the troops, we referred to Catherine's nephew, the Emperor Charles V, in the humorous context of the Tudors, in the real context of 1527, his troops sack Rome, wreaking unspeakable destruction on the city, you know, the rapes of nuns, horrible things done to cardinals, God only knows what. You can still see the Raphael cartoons actually singed in the loggia of the Vatican. You can still see them singed. Things like the papal chancery, where Henry's divorce would have been heard, are completely burnt out, and the redecorations have to start again in 1532. And from that moment onwards, so long as Charles's troops hold Italy, Henry has no chance. The only chance of a divorce depends on a French victory in Italy. Again, we've really got to get this international context there. That never happens. So Henry, this infinitely conventional man, this man who'd not only fought for the Pope in 1513, but had written the only full-blown royal defense of the papacy, with the Assertio Septem Sacramentorum against Martin Luther, which is, okay, this is not the papacy of Boniface VIII. This is not the papacy of Gregory XIII. This is not even the papacy of Pio IX. But it is a defense of the absolute centrality of the papacy to the unity of the faith. In other words, it's exactly the argument that More was going to use against Henry 10 years later. That's exactly what it's doing. Within 7 years of that, Henry starts to repudiate it because he cannot get his divorce the conventional way. And he embarks on this extraordinary, revolutionary course, which, as Eamon says, does actually change English history. And it's Henry who does it. George Bernard is here, and I would like to pay tribute to his book called The King's Reformation. It seems to me to be absolutely certain that Henry, the other people help, other people push, other people prod, Anne Cranmer at various stages, Edward Fox, Gardiner and whatever. But Henry himself seems to me to be in charge of that process at every single stage. But that process has utterly revolutionary consequences. The young Henry would have burned the old Henry. I mean, that seems to me to be the degree of shift. And for us, I think, we again have a great problem with people who, as it were, are still seriously religious themselves. We can take religion seriously. We, most of us, outside, beyond, above, having forgotten religion, need to grasp what this sort of shift, what the shift which is involved with the dissolution, what the shift which is involved with the destruction of images, which is involved in the destruction of deep-held religious practices, of places of pilgrimage and so on. This is a shift that tears people apart. It tore Henry apart, I think. The extraordinary coarsening of Henry's character, which I think, again, people are now beginning to focus on. Obviously, the physical events of 1536, the accidents, the injuries to his head and so on, the beginnings of the problem with his leg, do play their part. But I think to medicalize in that sense is to trivialize. What goes wrong with Henry is, of course, what also goes right. It is a man standing everything that he'd once believed on its head. There's a wonderful exchange between Tony Blair and William Hague. Hague, of course, always getting the better of Blair in Prime Minister's Question Time, much good it did him. And they were debating the young Blair, who had, of course, been an extremely left-wing CND-supporting MP. And Blair comes back in his characteristic fashion at Hague. He said, oh, come on. Do you believe everything you believed? You know, that slight glottal stop that comes in at these moments in 1987. A little faint touch of Australian when the going gets really rough there. And Hague comes back, and I can't possibly do Yorkshire, so I shan't try to, which is, Prime Minister, do you believe anything you believed in 1987? And that's what happens to Henry. He finds this extraordinary process of inversion. And that, I think, really is the genuine break in English history. The world before the... Geoffrey Elton was right for all the wrong reasons. The 1530s are a revolution. They are a divide. And they're not simply a religious divide, though that itself seemed to me to entail vast things. They're a divide in so many other things as well. As part of that process, as so often happens with great intellectual and religious revolutions, so many other things are invented as well. I think the idea of England is really invented, or the strong idea of England. It's Henry who actually comes up with the notion that England is a single strategic problem. We've all bought the myth that the last time England was invaded is 1066. Rubbish. Every change of regime in the Middle Ages is the result of an invasion, including Bosworth, which is a French invasion. Henry VII wins the throne with 20 little French ships and 2,500 Frenchmen. That's what actually happens in 1485. It's Henry who, for the first time, using the new techniques of Renaissance cartography and mathematics, which he was very interested in, maps the entire coastline of England as a single strategic problem and chooses where to site hugely heavily armed batteries, with, again, the ordnance which he is largely responsible for introducing the founding of into England. And you turn England into a fortified island. And then what do? You put a second layer around it, which is the navy, which you revolutionise completely. When Henry comes to the throne, the navy is a collection of fishing smacks. Off, there isn't one. In other words, it's the sink ports. What Henry does, he begins the move, which dramatically intensifies after 1539, because there is a European threat to heretical England, but there's also the money from the monasteries to do it. You create a deep sea fleet with these huge, heavy carrack boats that are designed to fire broadsides. They're the complements of the cannons on land, and they require deep sea ports, not the sink ports. The only one of the sink ports that survives is Dover, where Henry builds a special mole. Otherwise, the navy moves right down the Thames to Tilbury, to Portsmouth, to Plymouth. But it goes even beyond the idea of England as a single strategic problem. I would argue you actually invent the idea of English as a great language to go with this. The whole notion of Chaucer as the master poet, I think, really is invented as part of this propaganda. In fact, it's more than complete, as there are lots of false Chaucer poems in it. The first complete edition of Chaucer is 1532. Look at that date. Published by the king's printer and with an introduction written by the equivalent of Gordon Brown, by the treasurer of the chamber, making explicit the claim that English is a great language and that Chaucer is a combination of the English Homer and the English Virgil. That's what Henry does. And subsequent to that, of course, the great poets of the 1530s and the 40s, and again, my colleague Susan Brigden is here, who's worked so brilliantly on one of them, Wyatt and Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, they invent what we think of as the key poetic vehicles of the Elizabethans. They invent the sonnet and the blank verse. These are Henrician creations. Henry really is. Dickens said he was the spot of blood and grease. Well, it's appropriate, because he's actually the axis around which English history turns. It's no accident. It's roughly halfway between us and the Norman conquest. The English world, and I would argue the English-speaking world, not for nothing did I include California, revolves round Henry. He really does deserve that 500 years of fame.